Good morning, colleagues.
System works and makes that stuff.
Yeah. Audience members, internet audience members, welcome to this Monday, May 20th, 2013 meeting of the House Committee on Higher Education and Workforce Development. Today's topic is one that we have been brushing up against throughout this semester, and it is the subject of distance learning. Mm-hmm. And where we are as a state in terms of online education, where we're headed, and where we would like to be headed. Okay. And so we have some guests here today. I really appreciate you all coming here to Salem for this. And I'll call up, let me open this informational hearing, and I'll call up Melody Rose, Larry Large, and Steve Benning. Is Steve here? Not yet. Okay, let's start with Melody and Larry then.
Well, good morning, Chair Dembro and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Melody Rose, and I'm the interim chancellor of the Oregon University System. Thank you very much for the opportunity to talk with you today about this important subject. It's one that's near and dear to my heart, and so I'm looking forward to the dialogue. We use the term distance education when we talk about online learning, but that term actually began somewhere in the mid-1800s when correspondence courses were first used to reach geographically dispersed populations, literally with the Pony Express model of mailing materials or putting them on the back of a stagecoach to distant, far-reaching parts of our state. New channels were created in the 20th century, as you know, initially using radio and television. And now, of course, we've moved into a period of what I would call maturity with sophisticated online learning. Online learning continues to be, in my humble opinion, a matter of access. From remediation to advanced dual credit to reaching rural students and those with work-family responsibilities that make traditional classroom learning a difficulty. It has opened up education to students who previously had no access to the quality teaching that exists in our classroom by utilizing technology-enabled learning. Online learning has enabled higher education, and frankly, K-12 for that matter, to reach new students, use new teaching and learning modalities, and most importantly, improve student outcomes. And the force of my comments today will really be guided by that goal. This is a technology that can be used and should be used exclusively when it advances student outcomes. To give you a sense of how pervasive online learning is, today 8.7% of the total credits awarded by OUS institutions are taken as online learning credits. This number is up from 5% just 7 years ago, so the growth curve is quite brisk. In addition, many students are opting for a hybrid approach, which allows students to maximize the benefits of in-class and online instruction in the same course. In the 2011-2012 academic year, nearly 27% of all of our students system-wide took advantage of some kind of online learning, so it's becoming ubiquitous. Online learning is certainly challenging what I fondly refer to as the sage on the stage model of instruction. I like to think about the online model, and particularly when we look at things like math labs and flipped courses, as incorporating what I fondly think of as the Montessori philosophy of the teacher as guide, as opposed to sage on the stage.
Excuse me, can I butt in, Melody?
Of course.
You'll define the flipped course.
Thank you very much. The flipped course allows us to, you were right on target. The flipped course allows us.
I care about my colleagues.
Definitions, actually very important, thank you. The flipped course allows us to place pure content, facts, and formulas remotely in the online section of the course. And then class time, the in-class face-to-face opportunity where the teacher and learner are in the same place synchronously, which means at the same time in the same place, becomes more about connectivity and problem solving, where the professor can guide the students through meaning and lessons, providing context for the facts that they learned online, initiating practice, and focusing on theory building. That's what we refer to as the flipped class. So online learning has led to all kinds of course redesign needs because we simply can't take a class that happens face-to-face and toss it online. And that's a key component, I think, for our dialogue today. It's important to recognize that this new version of online learning is unique and it's different, and thus it requires substantial faculty development for the transition because you have a generation of faculty, frankly, who did not learn this way when they were in school themselves. And in order to help them flip their classes in the ways in which I just described, they need our support and, frankly, they need our investment. I want to talk a little bit about the effectiveness of online learning because I would imagine that that's something that's important to you all. And there are some recent data on effectiveness that has been produced by the Federal Department of Education. And in my written comments, there will be a link to that report so that you can reference it if you would like to learn more. And I want to tell you about four results that came from a massive study done in 2010. One, through a massive study done by the Department of Education, we learned that students actually perform moderately better in online learning settings than in face-to-face settings. Marginally, moderately better. The best student outcomes, however, come in what we call the hybrid courses. And these are the courses that maximize that face-to-face time and embellish it with online supports. So that's, I think, part of the discussion that we should pursue collectively as a state. Thirdly, what we know from this and many other studies is that collaborative learning environments where students interact with one another and with their instructor produce the best results of all and far superior to any kind of solitary learning environment. And that may be the image that comes to mind for you when you think of someone learning online in their basement in Gresham. That's the kind of scenario we want to avoid because those are where the results are the weakest. And fourth, and this becomes very important when we talk about quality and moving forward as a state, different learner types are affected differently by online pedagogy. And this is something that we can unpack further if there are questions from the committee, if you wish. As a professor, one of my favorite possibilities, and perhaps the most intriguing, is the potential in online learning for internationalization. And I'd like to spend some time, a few minutes, on this subject because it may be new to all of you. We can now jointly teach a course on supply chain management simultaneously in Portland and Tokyo. And we can convene joint projects either remotely or bring students together at the end of a term. This makes sharing resources possible with group projects essentially transcending oceans and bringing the world to place-bound students. And I'd like to give you an example of a faculty member at Portland State who is doing this kind of work very effectively, and it gives you a sense of the scope and possibility of online instruction. My former colleague, Professor Vivek Chandas at Portland State, uses Skype to provide guest lectures in his courses from internationally renowned scholars from Mexico, India, China, and Middle East countries, and other places where he currently has research collaborations ongoing. These guest lectures work well because they are consistent with the lecture format that many of our students are used to. But because Skype is free, he simply connects his personal computer to the classroom projection system and uses a microphone for students to engage faculty all over the world. He then engages a conversation about the differences and similarities in addressing environmental challenges from other parts of the world. And evaluations to Vivek's classes tell us that students refer to this style as compelling and inspired because they are able to see international cases and go well beyond the Pacific Northwest examples that they're typically hearing in other courses. And I also have a link in the prepared remarks so that you can look at one of these classes and experience that kind of interactivity. Now I'd like to turn to a couple of the myths about online learning, because I think that there are a lot of them out there, and I'd like to open up again some of the dialogue around some of these tougher questions. I think the main myth about online learning is that there are very few costs associated with it. And quite frankly, I hear that question coming up a lot as I walk the halls of Salem. And I want to be clear that this is not correct. Online learning is not free, and it's not cheap to deliver, and it's not a silver bullet. And just as an example, I'm sure you're all reading about the MOOCs in newspapers nationally, the massively open online courses that mostly elite institutions are providing, or you've heard about third-party vendors like Udacity doing similar things. Those institutions are essentially investing upwards of $250,000 each in class development. So we need to understand that while the end product from Harvard or MIT may be free, the investment was anything but. Costs include technological platforms that change frequently and thus have replacement and training costs that are not insignificant. Faculty development to learn a new delivery system and pedagogy have time and costs associated in very significant ways. And most importantly, the need to provide student supports does not disappear with online learning. In fact, in some ways, the needs grow because they are different than what the campuses currently provide. So it's important for us, I think, collectively to acknowledge these costs and confront them and make decisions strategically around them. Another myth about online learning courses is that we can accept unlimited enrollment in these classes. And here, too, you've heard about the million student classes, 100,000 student classes, and that experience that you read about from MOOCs is important for us to acknowledge and confront, because what we learn from those courses is that students who have no skin in the game, In other words, they're participating in the class for which they've not paid tuition, or they have no connectivity with other students or faculty participating in the course. Completion rates in those environments are horrendous. So it's very important for us to acknowledge that connectivity remains critical, even when you're learning online.
Yes, Rep. Greenlick.
Could you just provide us some of the data on your last statement?
Chair Denbrough, Representative Greenlick, thank you for the question. I wonder if you could clarify which piece specifically.
The completion rates.
Yes.
And you're speaking about the MOOCs.
I am speaking about the MOOCs, the large courses for which students don't have to pay tuition or any sort of entry threshold.
But and the statement was a situation where students don't have skin in the game.
Yes.
So I assume my scholarship students don't do well as well because they don't.
Thank you for the clarification. That's not what I'm suggesting. In the MOOCs, for which there is no barrier to entry, we see completion rates anywhere from 10 to 25%.
Oh, I think their most recent data is lower than that.
Yes. 6 and 8.
Well, it's quite a wide range is what I'm suggesting. Thank you, Chair Denbrough. And I'm not trying to make an analogy between those courses and our courses taught at our institutions. Just trying to, again, set aside some of the myths around online learning broadly. Does that answer your question, Representative Greenlick?
I'm not sure.
Actually, maybe I could jump in and help with that. You know, very often the MOOC students are students who are trying out higher education. They're maybe just taking one of them and fitting it into their everyday lives. They're free. There's no one keeping them on track, and so and they haven't put any money into it. But that's very different than a situation in which someone is a full-time college student and has a scholarship.
I understand the situation. What's the issue? I mean, you had 5,000 people into a student, and only 350 completed or something. So I'm into a class. So what? That's 350 kids that completed a class. I just don't understand how it's in this discussion.
Thank you, Chair Dembro, Representative Greenlee. I think my point there was that we have things we can learn from what's going on in the MOOCs. And the point and the thread that I'm trying to weave here is that connectivity is very important. And so because it does that kind of connectivity between students and between students and faculty doesn't exist in the MOOCs, that's a lesson for us in how we structure our online courses. So online instruction can mean coursework, of course, but just to point out quickly for you, there are other opportunities through distance education that are also quite powerful and I think promising, and I will note them quickly for you this morning. We can use online technologies to help us with student advising, with writing support, remediation, and very importantly, I think, given other conversations going on in this building, we can use distance education to help us with student orientations, debt counseling, curriculum mapping, and so forth. So the potential here is quite significant, and I'd like to turn, as I look at closing here in the next minute or two, I'd like to turn to what I think of as, in some ways, the most radical potential for online learning, and that is the use of analytics or big data. So let me explain what I mean by that term. With online learning, faculty can, depending on how they set up a course, have instant response rates from students and instantly know what they are learning and what they are not from a curriculum. And that is uniquely true with distance education and not the same with face-to-face. So we can literally embed online tutorials in any course in which we structure online learning, and this gives instant feedback. And let me give you an example of how I might do this as a political science faculty member. If I'm doing a lesson, for instance, on the Madisonian design of the American legislative branch, which I have done a few times, and students take an online tutorial, I get instant feedback about what they have gleaned and what they have not. So I can test at the end of a lecture, did they get the concept of bicameralism or did they not? And I can ask, did they see the connection between Madison's theory of federalism, for instance, and the contemporary fight between Oregon and the U.S. Attorney General on death with dignity? I can know that night. And then in response, I can take these results and tweak my course plan for the next day in order to respond to those areas of the curriculum that need a more significant touch and glide past the things which they already know. That's very powerful. And the reason I spend time on it with you this morning is that we can see through this example how we might actually be able to improve student learning if online learning is structured correctly. But we need to be strategic about triaging the order in which we apply distance education. And I'll give you my values on this, and you can kick them around at your leisure. Here are some of the examples, I think, where we have the most dire need for OUS and other institutions to approach online learning as a tool. One, we can prioritize what we call the bottleneck courses on our campuses. In other words, those courses that so many students need on a college campus that they can't proceed to degree as quickly as we might like, and we find that we hear these stories about barriers to completion because of bottleneck. How can we use online learning to free up those bottlenecks? Two, there are courses, not just here, but nationally, that are widely known for their high failure rates. This is another place of key priority for me. So, for instance, nationally, we know that the course most likely failed on any college campus is Math 111. And what we can do with online instruction is provide, perhaps free, perhaps not, depending on how a campus might structure it, pre-work for Math 111 that would be delivered in a distance way to prep students for entry into this class that so frequently becomes a barrier to success. And thirdly, I would suggest, too, that we prioritize courses that are used as prerequisites for large numbers of majors, again, to clear the pathway for students toward timely degree completion. And finally, and this is a passion of mine, how can we use online education to establish shared degrees across institutional boundaries. This is a place where OUS is leading, where we are having conversations among and between our campuses to learn how we can be more efficient by pooling our shared resources and effectively growing majors, which all can benefit from. So there is a way to save money in all of this, but it takes a deliberate strategy. And what I would say is that on the national scale, Oregon is really just beginning down this path. And the kinds of lessons that I pointed to this morning, I hope will inform our strategic decision making so that when we do this work, we do it well. We invest in our faculty because, quite frankly, if you don't have willing and talented and trained faculty, this will not succeed. And where I think we can become both more efficient and we can improve student learning outcomes. So I'll stop there. I want to cede my the rest of the time to my colleague Larry Large and see if there are any questions from the committee.
Thank you very much, Madam Chancellor.
Chair.
Yes.
Can I, before we move on, I do have a couple of questions or a question and a couple of comments.
Okay.
First, I'm curious if we could flip back to the flip course. I'm just curious about accreditation standards. So the average course requires 12 to 15 contact hours for one credit, sort of the basic equation for accreditation. How do those contact hours get met with this flip arrangement? Mm-hmm. In other words, does the student participating in some of the reading or looking at materials prior to the contact with the instructor, does that get counted in the 12 hours or 15 hours? Or?
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Chair Dembro and Representative Gallegos. I appreciate that question, and accreditation is near and dear to my heart, so you're spot on. We still have methods of measuring those contact hours. Just because a student is participating in a distance format doesn't mean that we can't measure that contact with faculty, because in some ways, in fact, it becomes easier to measure that contact with faculty because we're able to look at it through a digitized lens.
Yeah.
So in some ways, the matters become easier. That said, different accreditation bodies are confronting these issues very differently. And if I can be quite frank, I think the Northwest approach on this has been a little bit behind the curve. WASC, which accredits California and Hawaii, on the other hand, has become far more progressive and forward-thinking on a number of these fronts, and I frankly think we have a lot to learn from them. So I have engaged them in some conversations, and I'm hoping to get out to Hawaii to talk to them.
Oh,
about
yeah, right. Yeah. Can I follow up? Yeah, because I do think that would certainly be part of our consideration with regard to cost and so on in terms of faculty time, and which gets me to my other two comments. One, you mentioned the myth about online programs and the fact that we lose a lot of student contact. In other words, my notion about an important element for learning in higher education is the student support system, mm-hmm. the contact, the socialization they get from other students, mm-hmm. and I think that's something that would be missing. Mm-hmm. The other comment I had to do with, on this committee we talk a lot about higher education, we talk about community colleges, we talk about 4-year degrees, we've talked a little bit about graduate education, and I was just thinking as you were talking about doctoral education, we haven't really talked about it here much, but most PhD programs, most doctoral programs do not teach how to teach. Mm-hmm. And it seems to me that might be something we need to look at is in preparation of faculty in terms of how do we educate PhDs to use this kind of technology and so on. Mm-hmm. But anyway, just comments. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Dembro and Representative Gallegos. I appreciate that, in particular, that last remark about graduate education. And I'll just say briefly, so that I don't take too much of the time here, I would be more than happy to come and talk to the committee about graduate education. It's, as you all know, very expensive education, and how we approach it strategically as a system, I think, is very important. And focusing more as we move forward as a state on pedagogy and instruction expectations, in particular of PhDs, is a topic of real concern to me as well.
Good. Thank you.
Great. Jennifer, did you have a quick something on this issue that you wanted to address?
Graduate education.
No. I mean, is that why you came up to deal with the question of seat time, et cetera?
No.
Okay, because I have you later on the agenda. So,
oh, okay.
Yeah. So I want to hear from Larry, then we'll hear from the faculty, and then I want your national perspective.
Mr. Chair.
I'm sorry, Rep. Wisnett.
Madam Chancellor, you made a comment that OSU has been slow in distance learning. Could you give your opinion of why that is? And also, I thought that the Western Governors University, which I think you're supporting, is a good movement towards that.
Thank you, Chair Dembro and Representative Wisnett. If I said that OSU is slow to this, I misspoke. What I intended to convey is that Oregon, as a state, has not been as progressive on these issues as I would like to see them. Actually, OSU has quite an accomplished set of online instruction programs, and they've done quite a good job, in particular, on this matter of data analytics. In fact, I talked just two nights ago with one of their chief proponents of online learning on their campus, and they're really leading some of these issues of how do we study the students as we're teaching them. So OSU, in particular, is a leader in this field. As you know, Eastern Oregon University has quite an array of online opportunities as well. So no, I did not mean to point to any particular institution. In terms of Western Governors University, I take a temperate view of their role in this arena. I think, again, as we approach any of these online learning opportunities, we have to be led by what are the student outcomes. And I think very frequently in the national dialogue about online learning, there's a race to distance education as a silver bullet for budget problems. And what I would like to do, and pardon my pen, is to flip that conversation and make sure that as we're approaching online learning, we are leading by asking what is most effective to student learning.
Just a
follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We had a great presentation last week, and it was actually Western Oregon talking mm-hmm. about how that. But there, you know, your comments about it's not inexpensive. I understand that, but it also affects living cost, and that's more than half of your cost of going to education. So we have to look at that too. Thank you.
Absolutely. Yeah, Vice Chair Huffman and Representative Wisnett. There are two costs that can be alleviated on the other side of the ledger, and really implicitly you point to both. One is housing. So if you have students who don't have to move their housing to near their campus, that might alleviate a pressure on student. And the other one that I would point out, which is implicit in your remark and equally important, is the pressure on capital construction. So that's the other component of this that needs to be measured as we're balancing out the ledger.
Thank you.
Yep.
Okay, Larry.
Okay.
Good morning. Welcome.
I'm Larry Large, for the record. I am president of the Oregon Alliance for Independent Colleges and Universities. We are an organization that is the product of a merger of a couple of years ago, where the old Oregon Independent Colleges Association and the Oregon Independent Colleges Foundation merged to form one organization representing the independent colleges. There are 19 of us, and I won't. I'll do my best here not to be redundant to the wonderful background and context statement that Chancellor Rose has already provided you. Being handed out, there are five pages of materials that I will try to summarize here briefly and effectively, and make optimal use of your time. Collectively, in the 19 institutions, we have an enrollment of 32,000, almost 400 students. And of those 19, 11 of them offer online education or distance education. And they represent, in terms of the percentage of the number of students involved, last year, at fall of 2012, these data points are driven from, there were 4,780 students who were taking some distance education, either full, all of their curriculum or some portion of it was being taken online out of the 32,000 plus. That represents about 9% of the total enrollment, or about 15% of the enrollment of those 11 schools that do offer distance education. Breaking it down quickly between graduate and undergraduate, the undergraduate students, of that 4,800 or approximately that number, just a little under 1,900 are undergraduate students, or about 9% of the campuses that are involved. And the graduate students represent about 900, or 35% of the enrollment of the graduate students is online, at least in some part-time version of it. Between resident and non-resident, our students, of the 32,400, 53% of our students are Oregon residents. And the non-residents who are involved in distance education, we've got Oregon students take just under 1,200 of the students take online courses, and in the non-residents, we've got 1,800 plus who are online. Well, some general comments, and just to give you that background, and those metrics are embedded in the materials that you have there. The 11 institutions that offer online courses are highly varied within themselves. You have on the one end across the street, we have a Willamette University that has a very tiny program in the graduate education program that's online. And on the other end of it, we've got Corbin, which is not far from here, that has a mixture of graduate, undergraduate, resident, non-resident, and international students who take their courses for credit from Corbin online. And then in the middle, you've got a Linfield College that is only undergraduate, no graduate program, and they have a very robust program of degree completion and of a fully online curriculum for completing a bachelor's degree. This is targeted, as along with Merrillhurst University and Warner Pacific, Northwest Christian, and Concordia, all have a very aggressive program in trying to reach into that population that has some college but never finished a degree. And the idea of migrating and achieving the 40-40-20 goals, we know we have to reach back into that population. So some of these schools have entirely online opportunities, so they're asynchronous. They lack some of the qualities that Chancellor Rose spoke of in terms of the interaction, but there are a number of ways in which digitally that communication goes on, and there's some student-to-student learning that goes on, even when there's not face-to-face context for it. Now, why do we do this? I think the important point that we want to make here is this is an innovation, or as some writers at Harvard call it, a disruption to the traditional patterns of higher education, economics and pedagogy. What we want to use this experience with, we want to learn, can it be expanded? Can it be done better? Can we use it? For whom is it effective, and for whom is it not effective? So it's a very important testing ground for our campuses to have these 11 institutions among our 19 who are using it effectively, but also it's an ever-evolving technology and an ever-evolving process by which we're engaging in these programs. It is particularly relevant, in my opinion, to the dual credit issues and the credit for prior learning. Chancellor Rose and I both serve on a subcommittee of the Higher Education Coordinating Commission on credit for prior learning. In the state, we have one person who's at Merrillhurst University who's probably the international expert on the various ways in which one assesses prior learning. There's a very important point with this that we don't, and Chancellor Rose spoke to that. We don't want to get ahead of ourselves in terms of thinking that credit for prior learning is going to be, as to use her metaphor, a silver bullet. the important test of whether there's real credit for that prior learning is what are the learning outcomes from those experiences. And it's not just experience, it's learning. It's credit for prior learning, not credit for prior experience. And that distinction is very critical, and distance education can help us understand that better. And it also, the learning has to match a particular college curriculum or a course. So it's not just a random, non-integrated set of learning experiences, but it goes to a coherent degree that's ultimately offered using some of those credits to meet the test for graduation with a certain degree. I think it also affects dual credit in the high schools. I think there are multiple models here about how that's done. There's the International Baccalaureate. There is the College Board's, why am I blanking on the advanced placement opportunities if you take a test and pass it at a certain level. And now you have the Eastern Promise that Eastern Oregon University is doing very effectively. And there are other models like that. But there is an additional model that we're working on, and that is to offer an actual online course to a student while in high school in a distant part of the state so that we can make that progress toward graduation and not waste time of that student who already has the necessary courses for high school or who can use this class experience literally in the form of a dual credit for the high school so that we're making the highest and best use of all of the educational resources. On the matter of the MOOCs, a couple of things I would supplement Chancellor Rose's comments. Number one, if you look at the enrollment in those MOOCs, a majority of the students who are enrolled, massive numbers of them, already have degrees. Many of them have PhD degrees. Now, that doesn't make them less valuable because we can learn from that, but at the moment, they don't represent massive democratization of educational opportunity for those who are uneducated. So we have to find out what are the strong points of that kind of delivery and how can it be translated and applied to students who are still below the bachelor's degree and who need to use that to move on. In this week's Atlantic Magazine, the digital form, by the way, not the printed form, there's a very interesting essay about how the economics of this will work. It turns out that the actual cost of instruction, as Dr. Rose pointed out, there's not massive savings in that. There's infrastructure costs, there are other costs involved with it. But where the real savings in the long run is the reduction in related services. We talked about housing, you talk about some of the other things. And while there are alternative services that are going to be needed and important, you don't have a lot of the athletics, you don't have a lot of the same kind of regulatory issues that you do sometimes with a housing program or food service on a campus. So the MOOCs are something that we watch closely and we want to learn from. It's not fully clear yet exactly how to really leverage that to the benefit of Oregon students and the Oregon institutions. I'll stop there, take questions, or happy to talk about other things.
Great. Thank you, Larry. And yes.
Thank you, Chair. It kind of gets back to the other discussion as well, in terms of the student learning style. And I'm thinking about this in terms of my own experience, let's say. I know a lot of people who are a heck of a lot brighter than me and can't do anything. They're just like that. And other folks who I have questions about, but they're doers. And as we move to outcome, performance outcomes, I'm trying to think how that plays out in terms of style of pedagogy, style of teaching.
Vice Chair Huffman and Representative.
Yeah.
The process of evaluating these learning outcomes, there's not a single way to do that. Testing for it, like the College Board does, is a way. But there are portfolios, there are faculty interviews, there are different ways in which you can get a richer picture of what the student is capable of performing, not just the two-dimensional, do you know the content?
Yeah.
So, and the really good credit for prior learning evaluative processes are hybrid or multi-brid. I don't think that's a word, but I'll make it up. But there are these ways to look at the full capacity of the student learner.
If I may, Vice Chair Huffman and Representative, when I started the Center for Online Learning at Portland State a few years ago when I was still on the campus, I learned a really critical lesson, which was that many of the students that I was working with at Portland State, many of whom, of course, are first-generation students, not entirely technologically literate, did not necessarily have technology in their homes growing up like more privileged kids do. We learned something very valuable in offering a class on how to take online classes. Mm. And again, it was one of those forms of student supports that I'm referencing, right? The online learning can go well beyond the classroom in the way that we serve our students. And I think that was one of the most critical things that we put in place because it helped us learn at the outset who's likely to succeed in this environment and who needs scaffolding to succeed in this environment. And then we would try to proceed from there. The point, however, is again, more resources necessary in order to do that well.
Vice Chair Huffman, I think also one of the assets of the distance education and the online learning is we now have a multiple entry menu that can more closely be matched or customized to different groups of different students' needs for pedagogy, for different learning environments. So this is no small matter, as a matter of fact. And it's one of those things that I think we have to keep in mind here. I just finished an essay on this. But there are some myths, as Chancellor Rose pointed out, and then one of them that in this industry that we're dealing with is there is a continuum, a horizontal continuum of different ways in which people earn a bachelor's degree. Our image as a society, and I think our conversation is compromised at times because we have such a strong stereotypical image of going to a residential college at age 18, doing it in 4 years. Well, you know from the metrics that that's now 5.5 and 6 years in a lot of places. We're real proud at among our schools. We're a little better than that. We've got about a 60% graduation rate now in 4 years. And while that's not as high as I wish it were, it is relatively speaking a good metric. But if you move across, you get different kinds of investments to be made and different kinds of returns on investment across that continuum. When you move from the very elite Ivy League kind of institution to the research universities that are private and public, to the flagship institutions that are done in states, over to different kinds of liberal arts colleges. And by the way, the liberal arts, I want to take this opportunity to say, include science. Okay? People forget that, and sometimes you just think about the humanities when we're talking about liberal arts degrees. Liberal arts includes the humanities, the social sciences, and the sciences. Our schools graduate about 22% of our degrees are in STEM courses, even though they're largely liberal arts colleges. But all I'm trying to say, Representative, is that there is a range of investments of time, money, and return on those investments in our industry. And that's probably a good thing because we have to get as many different options as possible if we're going to attain the 40-40-20. We want to be contributing partners in the independent sector to those goals, and we're real clear about that. Now, while we only get a tiny amount of state dollars, $4 million, and it's done through the Oregon residents who are Oregon Opportunity Grant recipients. But in our situation, if Oregon's public education system and its public higher education system is not flourishing, we're not going to do well. Our economy will not do well. Our interests as a group of independent institutions are aligned very closely with what the state's overarching interests are for higher education.
Great. Representative Gillum.
Thank you, Mr. Temporary Chair. Thank you both for being here, and Larry, thank you particularly for your patience with this committee over the last few days. You may know I was a pioneer in stretching 5 years into out of a four-year
I remember
degree
something about
years ago. But I want to get back to the cost issue just for a moment, and I want to ask you both. I appreciate your comments, Chancellor, about don't assume this is a cheap way to learn, and right. there are other costs. However, there are, on the other side of the ledger, some savings. Generally speaking, in the public and private sector, are tuition rates the same as traditional learning, or are there some major savings to be had?
Thanks, Larry. Vice Chair Huffman, Representative, that's an excellent question. And if you look nationally, what you will find is a baseline or a generality is that tuition remains the same, but very frequently institutions apply a surtax for online instruction. And that is very common nationally. It is true for some of our institutions within the OUS. And the reason for that surcharge, which sometimes is a flat fee per course, and in other instances can be a per credit hour surcharge, which is more common within our system, is that we have not had a dedicated strategic investment in by the state in distance education to basically get going with startup costs. So in order to buy the technology platforms, the learning management systems that go along with those platforms, the hardware, the training facilities, et cetera, our campuses have had to rely, many of our campuses have had to rely on a surcharge for those students. Now, those surcharges are not without their controversy, as you might well imagine. And as we look at higher costs for education, we worry about those. We have not seen any decline in demand that goes along with those surcharges, which has been an interesting thing to observe. And we believe that in part it's because of the efficiencies that the students gain alongside with those distance options. So for instance, while at Portland State, again, a non-traditional student body, many students in talking with me about paying that additional cost would say, well, on the backside of that, I don't have to drive downtown every single day. I don't have to hunt for parking on the Portland State campus or environs, and don't have to deal with maybe the same child care costs or elder care costs. So we do hear from a number, particularly of non-traditional students, that the cost that they bear is offset by other kinds of financial savings.
Vice Chair Huffman and Representative Gillum, there are two major areas where there are cost reductions for the delivery of the online courses. One of those is simply the fact that our colleges generally, as you know, have a discounting form of tuition for those who are less capable of paying the tuition. So we don't discount typically on those online courses. So their rack rate value is much closer to the net price on the campus. But so it's probably somewhere between $1,200 and $1,500 a course. And if you do the math on that, you'll see that that's a cheaper price. The second place goes exactly to what we were talking about before on the related services. You don't have the on-campus healthcare, you don't have on-campus security system, you don't have athletic costs, you don't have those different things that are not accruing to the benefit of the online students.
Sure. We need to move on.
I
apologize.
All right, no,
we really, Chancellor Larry, thank you so much.
Thank you all very much.
Appreciate your time and your insights. Jennifer and Steve, you may not be that compatible, but you'll be the next panel. Come on up. Jennifer, if you'll kick us off, please. We're running a few minutes behind, so Jennifer, go ahead, and on deck, Kevin, Candace, and Jeffrey. It'll be Kevin and Jeffrey. Jennifer.
Thank you, Representative Huffman, and all the members. For the record, I'm Jennifer Diallo, the Director of the Office of Degree Authorization, and I'm just going to speak from more of a national perspective and about our experience dealing with distance education providers, colleges and universities mostly outside the state that are offering distance education, as well as to address some of the other issues. What we have seen in distance education applications from colleges and universities outside of Oregon is that these are primarily focused in professional fields, the same sort of range of degree programs that, for example, Western Governors offers is the same range that we'll see at most colleges and universities. A lot of the schools appear to have grown their distance education unit out of their extended studies or professional studies or sort of a continuing ed type of program. So that makes sense that it would, you know, they already had perhaps a technology platform to offer continuing ed, and these programs have grown somewhat out of that. And so you'll see in some cases the distance ed component of the university is offered completely outside of the sort of normal academic programs at the university and in a separate division. In some cases, this is a concern because, you know, perhaps they're not using the same types of curriculum models and such as they are at the university. And so there has, in some cases, been a perception that a degree offered online is significantly different than the same degree offered at the campus. I've heard this with respect, for example, to particularly professional degrees at the master's and doctoral level in relation to education or particularly in the case of education, that a doctorate in education earned through the professional studies program may be significantly different than a doctorate in education earned from the program on campus. We recognize that in Oregon, distance education is vital. We have a large rural population. We have a lot of working professionals, particularly in fields like mental health, that are interested in staying in their rural location, staying in eastern Oregon or southern Oregon or the coastal Oregon, and earning a doctorate in nursing practice or a doctorate in counseling psychology that they need to stay relevant in their field and not interested in relocating to the valley, which is really where all those programs are located in Oregon, or going out of state. And so it is very vital, and so we do everything we can to sort of facilitate the bringing, you know, high quality programs into Oregon and supporting the schools in Oregon, you know, to the extent that we have any relevance with providing information and support to share with them, for example, some of the programs offered by out-of-state universities that appear to be, you know, popular. We're in sort of a unique position, and I see this as a sort of, I mentioned it down in the 40-40-20 section as well. You know, we're in a unique position in that we see everything that is coming in, and we hear from students that say, I really need this program. It's not offered anywhere else in the Northwest. It's not offered anywhere else on the West Coast. This school in Texas or this school in another place is the only school that offers this particular specialization of nursing or, you know, some particular. And so then I can, you know, we're in a position where we can ask, for example, our university system or maybe put some schools in contact with each other. We've done that in the past with some private research universities outside the state that want to offer certain programs that might be beneficial for them to collaborate with OHSU or with one of the OUS schools to be able to offer these programs, you know, in Oregon at perhaps a lower cost by doing more of a coordinated model. And I know that I've seen some evidence that the OUS schools, as Chancellor Rose alluded to, have been approaching this very creatively and looking for places where they can offer these programs in partnerships or in both within their system and with external partners in ways that are more cost effective. So that's a real progress in our mind and a benefit to students.
I'm sorry, if I could interject a question. Who is responsible for notifying the student whether a particular program that they're going to take, whether it's an individual class or a complete course line from an institution, is going to be recognized by a board or a commission in Oregon? We started out this session with a psychology educational program, for example, and a number of students in Oregon have been enrolled in that and graduated, mm-hmm. then to find out that it's not particularly recognized by the board in Oregon?
That's an excellent question, Representative Huffman, and I really appreciate it because it is an issue. Who's responsible is the institution. However, what happens at times is that licensing boards make changes to their rules in a situation, and this was the case with psychology, I think I've alluded to it before in previous presentations, where the board makes a change that significantly impacts students that are currently enrolled in the program, and because of the timeline of the change, it affects those students who recently graduated and students that have not even yet graduated, and they may or may not be informed because the school is recognized, for example, by us, and their degrees are valid in Oregon, but they may not be recognized by the licensing board because they've changed a rule or because they, have decided to, in this case with psychology, they decided to require a certain type of accreditation that's not available to distance learning programs. And so at the time that occurred, our office was very concerned because of, again, the issue with students that are out in rural areas that are enrolled in online education that may not have this information and have already made a significant investment in their education. And unfortunately, one of the issues is that you don't necessarily know whether a student has taken the program online or on the ground at a university that has a campus. And so to make such a distinction and say, a school may in another state may have its APA accreditation for their on-the-ground program and offer the program online, and the students come to a specific site to do what they call the academic year in residence during, specific periods, and an online university can't, they may do almost the same layout of the program, but they can't necessarily qualify for the APA accreditation because they don't have an on-the-ground, on-campus program. So you have a situation where a student may effectively be licensed in the state having taken a program online from a university that has a campus, while another student took a program online from a university that doesn't have a physical campus, and so it's clear that their program's online, and in a sense there's a discrepancy.
Well, in the situation, the example you gave where a board changes a rule, mm-hmm. moves the goalpost for the student, is there a role the legislature could play, or who's going to advocate for that student? Because a lot of them that I've heard testimony from have had quite an investment up to that mm-hmm. point.
I agree with you, and we have tried to advocate for that student where possible and to make it clear to the board. We don't have any control over the decision that the board makes. And, in my mind, when these types of decisions are made regarding students who have already made a significant investment, I think the board has an obligation to consider the students that are currently enrolled and to make provisions for those students. We would expect schools to make provisions for the students wherever possible and to inform the students as soon as possible. But where someone is in a PhD program and they've already invested perhaps 3 or 4 years into a very expensive education, I think that there needs to be some obligation to, see those students through. Unfortunately, if they haven't graduated yet and haven't received a license yet, from a licensing board perspective, my perception from conversations we've had with various licensing boards is they really look at this as an individual person applying for a licensing board. We look at it in terms of a school being approved by, having the correct accreditation or whatever, that they're approved by a licensing board. But the licensing boards don't look at it as approving the school. They look at it as approving a licensure application when it comes in. So that already implies graduation. So they're not even able to understand why we're talking to them about a school, because they're really only looking at the person after they already have a degree. So I think there is the real disconnect. Because we can approve the school based on meeting certain standards, meeting our standards. We can strongly state that they need to be in compliance with all Oregon licensing boards. But if the school is in compliance with the licensing board at the time it enrolls the student and then the licensing board changes and the school cannot get any kind of approval from the licensing board, the student is still going to be impacted. I don't know what the legislative solution is, but that's really the issue, is the disconnect where we're taking an application from a school, the licensing board is taking an application from an individual person who already graduated. Does that help? Okay.
Yeah, I'm not sure what the solution is either, but wanted to get some stuff on the record.
So yeah.
Thank you.
I would echo what Chancellor Rose said and also Larry Large about online education is not for all learners. I think schools have learned this. I think a lot of schools have gone into online education, as Chancellor Rose said, thinking it's going to be a silver bullet for budget. Our perception is that an awful lot of schools outside the state, and particularly public universities and community colleges, have gone into online education in a sense of, oh, we have this online education set up for our campus in order to save costs on facilities, in order to provide more flexibility for our current students, and then they start offering them to students outside the state or even outside their local region without much thought as to the student support. And so I think we've seen a lot of sort of failure of distance education because of that lack of foresight and thinking through how are we going to support and supervise, in the case of clinical placements, student teaching placements, students that are in another geographic location in another state with different licensing regulations. So most of the issues that we've seen with distance education have to do with not the lack of coherence necessarily between higher education standards, but the lack of coherence among states with licensing standards, where a doctor of nursing practice has a very different role in Oregon than it does in another state. And so we have significant expectations for someone graduating from a doctor of nursing practice program that they may not have in Ohio, they may not have in another state. And if the school has not paid attention to those licensing regulations before they enroll students, we have serious issues. There are some plans to move towards interstate reciprocity, and unfortunately, there hasn't been a way to really coordinate that with licensing changes. And so even the interstate reciprocity proposals that are coming up in the next few months do not take into account programs that relate to licensure. And from our perspective, that's a significant number of the online programs, so it doesn't change very much at all in our world in terms of supporting these students. The benefit or the positive thing is that there's a lot more information out there, a lot more people are aware of the issue, and even within, for example, the nursing profession, students are becoming aware of the need to make sure that their school meets the conditions, and students are having to take a much more active role because institutions have not done so in making sure that they have, checked with the appropriate licensing board, that their school has state authorization. I think there's a growing awareness, and this is improving, but there's still a long ways to go, and we're still seeing an awful lot of students that are enrolled prior to their school seeking to coordinate with the licensing board or with our office, for example.
Okay, thank you. Jennifer, I'm going to interrupt you and let Steve speak.
Okay.
Sorry, everyone. I had to go present a bill on guess what subject? Online education in the K-12 world. But Steve, could you speak to us about the community college world and distance learning?
Certainly. Chair Dembro,
great to see you.
For recognizing me, and good morning, everyone. I've been an educator for 21 years and started in K-12.
Oh, yes, Steve, could you give us your name for the record?
Oh, yes. Steve Bining. I'm a faculty member at Clackamas Community College. And as I was describing, 21 years as an educator, I've had lots of experience to work with technology. I've had both faculty and administrative roles in K-12 and as a faculty member in higher education at Clackamas Community College. And I'll earn my EDD, Doctor of Education, this year from Portland State. I started at Clackamas Community College in 2008, and my job roles there are really deeply involved in distance learning at the community college. I am a full-time faculty member teaching online. I am a department chair of the distance learning department, so I have an administrative role supporting distance learning at Clackamas. I'm also part of the faculty development group, where I work with faculty to help develop their ability to teach online. And I'm also, in the last 2 years, have served as a co-chair of the Oregon Community College Distance Learning Association, and I've been making connections with all of the other community colleges and their leaders of distance learning. So I've have developed a fairly comprehensive knowledge of distance learning at the community college level. Chancellor Rose gave a nice overview of the emergence and growth of distance learning. I'll talk about how that has played out at Clackamas. We've had a distance learning program at Clackamas since 1999. We offer a fully online hybrid, which are courses that are both seat time and online, and blended learning, and of course offer web facilitated courses as well for face-to-face courses. And just to give an example of how things have changed, in 2008, when I first got to the college, we served just under 5,000 students. And last year, we served just over 12,000. So we've more than doubled within 5 years. And as you might imagine, the faculty at Clackamas are at all levels of readiness for teaching in the online classroom. Many are eager and active, and they're learning all the different techniques that are necessary to be successful online, but we do have some faculty who are just beginning or even resisting adopting these new delivery methods. And students, too, at the community college are at all levels of readiness for success with distance learning. For example, I teach a online intro to distance learning course for new students, and they come in with all differing levels of technology expertise, access to technology, and readiness to learn online. Distance learning greatly expands access and flexibility for those who have the technology and skills to learn online. We do need to recognize there is a digital divide amongst community college students. Many students who might not have technology at home, internet access at home, or maybe very slow dial-up access, certainly in the rural areas, that's a concern. But all 17 of the community colleges do have online programs. The Oregon Community College Distance Learning Association provides opportunities for the community colleges to work together. This allows economies of scale to be used to save money and time amongst the colleges. For example, we've coordinated several purchases of services across the community colleges. For example, we all use a program called Blackboard Illuminate, which is a video conferencing tool. We use it to conduct our meetings on occasion, and also it's available to all of our distance learning programs at our schools. We, through OCCDLA, coordinate an online course design quality rubric called Quality Matters that helps us make sure we're offering high quality distance learning courses. We've recently all worked together to provide captioning for online videos for students who need accommodations. We have a shared instructional video libraries and instructional material libraries. We work together on learning about and introducing emerging technologies for learning. For example, we've recently, in the last 5 years, we had a virtual campus called Through Second Life, where we were able to go and meet, which is a virtual world. Support from CCWD has been crucial to making these things happen, and I urge the committee to continue to support CCWD's efforts to provide leadership within distance learning. Clackamas Community College is investing in improving student success in online courses. We're expanding our capacity for producing instructional media. We're using the latest learning management systems. Ours is called Moodle. Others may use Blackboard or Desire to Learn or other learning management systems. And we're increasing the use of assessment tools and learner analytics based in our LMS. We provide comprehensive training for our online faculty in the newest instructional techniques and technologies. We're growing our capacity for high-quality distance learning offerings. We recognize that e-learning and distance learning are our future. It is part of our strategy for growth. Many departments are improving and growing their online offerings. So thanks for listening.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Steve. Okay, a quick question. And then, Jennifer, I'm actually going to ask you to go back, and I'm going to bring up the two other faculty members. Okay. And then we can direct questions, you know, to the practitioners.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Steve, is there uniformity amongst the 17 community colleges as far as the requirements and the teaching model? Because I've heard complaints, honestly, from students that have talked about the lack of response from the online instructor, not getting back to them within the deadline for the coursework to be completed and things like that. Is that starting to improve?
Well, I think so, as more and more practitioners teach online. But yeah, that level of inconsistency is certainly a problem at Clackamas, and I would imagine at other institutions as well. But we do, at Clackamas, we offer comprehensive training in all different methods of online teaching and learning, and we hope the faculty avail themselves. I believe all the colleges have offer similar opportunities.
Just a quick comment.
Yes.
One of the things I've noticed, too, is that as institutions have gotten into online learning, and our student, I think, has dramatically changed over the last 5 years or so because of the recession. I've witnessed where the instructor has failed to see that they're not dealing necessarily with the 18 or 19-year-old traditional student in the classroom setting, but they're dealing with a 30-year-old mother with one or two kids, single mom, and it's a different type of learner there for a different reason. And so I would just encourage that as part of the input to recognize who the learner is online.
Yes, thank you for that, Representative Huffman. I will remember that and take that back to the colleges.
Thank you.
Okay, Jeff and Kevin, welcome. Who wants to go first?
Chair Dembrough and members of the committee, good morning. For the record, my name is Jeff Dentz. I am professor of political science at Eastern Oregon University, immediate past president of the EOU Faculty Senate, and am currently serving as president-elect of the Oregon University System Inter-Institutional Faculty Senate. Representative Dembrough has asked us to address a range of issues surrounding the future of online education. I've taught online for over a decade, have presented and conducted workshops at national conferences on this important topic, and recently engaged my IFS colleagues in robust discussions on online education. A three-pronged approach which utilizes the lenses of students, the institution, and the system is warranted to best understand the relationship between quality control and online education. While I've recently engaged students in focus groups and personal interviews on the topic of online education, I can't hope to capture the full range of issues they may see as relevant in the limited time we have today. However, two student-centered issues come to the forefront during this dialogue. A majority of online campus students do not appreciate being forced to take online courses as part of their academic requirements, eschewing face-to-face interaction with teaching faculty, and more importantly, their classmates, has left a number of campus-based students with a bad taste in their mouth. Students crave the attention that regular, not part-time adjunct faculty provide in these classes, as these faculty members serve an important mentoring role for students. I would urge the committee to gather a group of students to provide their insights into best practices in online education, and I'm sure you'd find their perspective enlightening. A second perspective on quality control centers on the institution's role in online education. At EOU, approximately half of our student credit hours are conducted in the online course environment. Yet my experience as assessment coordinator and chair of the Faculty Personnel Committee tells me that the higher ed community is not doing a good job overall of evaluating the performance of online teaching faculty. I recently was entrusted with the task of revising EOU's tenure and promotion handbook. While we made significant inroads to protecting the best interest of future generations of faculty, one issue we couldn't get our arms around was the evaluation of online teaching. There are a number of wide range of pedagogical and technological differences concerning distance education that make evaluation of teaching performance in this modality challenging. Admittedly, there are some exceptions to the rule. Cal State Chico has developed a rubric for online instruction, and I provided a link in my written comments, that while not a perfect fit for all institutions, provides a sound and widely tested instrument for evaluating online teaching performance. Assessment, of online academic programs must be rooted in the regular evaluation of the performance of online faculty members. The big ticket issue that confronts you and the future of higher education in Oregon centers on how the system will ensure the quality of online education in Oregon. The Sloan Consortium, one of the leading players in the online education debate, has created the five pillars of quality online education, and I provided a link in my remarks. They are learning effectiveness, scale, that is cost effectiveness and commitment, access, faculty satisfaction, and student satisfaction. Ignoring any of these pillars in the development and subsequent assessment of online academic programs will invariably lead to problems down the road. Sloan has also created a quality scorecard for the administration of online education, and I provided a link in my comments, underscoring the multifaceted nature of the debate over online education. The scorecard assesses 70 different quality indicators, broken down into 9 categories. Of the 9 categories, Sloan weighs student support the most heavily, whether it is advising before starting an online program, technological support during the course, or attempts to engage the distance student with the campus proper via library and information services. The quality of online education is highly correlated with the amount of support available to students. Quality online education programs require a significant investment in student services that may be difficult to isolate during these economically challenging times. I teach in an interdisciplinary program at DOU, philosophy, politics, and economics, or as we call it, PPE. This was one of the first fully deliverable online programs in the state of Oregon. We pride ourselves that our online students receive as close as possible to the same educational experience as their on-campus cohorts. This is made possible by the fact that, with very rare exceptions, these courses are taught by the same faculty in both online and on-campus modalities. As online education expands in Oregon public universities, given workload issues, curricular expansion, and the specter of accreditation, one must weather whether the same quality of education will be available to the online student as their on-campus classmates. While hybrid courses hold some promise, a number of challenges, for example, synchronous versus asynchronous learning, may provide a significant impediment to quality control of online education in Oregon. During our IFS meeting last weekend in beautiful La Grande, my colleagues raised issues concerning the differential cost of online versus on-campus classes. In order to fund the technological initiatives and faculty support that serve as the bedrock of effective online education, students have, in several instances, been forced to shoulder a significant financial burden as an institution ramps up its online presence. Although there is some limited external funding to be pursued, I wonder whether Oregon's public universities may be losing their comparative cost advantage to for-profit institutions, MOOCs, and public institutions in other states. While I'm keenly aware of the financial challenges confronting the future of higher education in Oregon, IFS would like for you to contemplate whether having our online students burdened with additional debt in the name of access makes sense.
Jeff, can I just jump in for a moment? And what is the premium that students pay for doing an online class? What is the extra fee that they pay at Eastern? And how does that is it uniform among the 7 universities, or it's completely different? Yeah.
Thank you, Chair Denbrough, for your question. A recent initiative by President Davis has attempted to minimize the differential cost between the online and on-campus courses, where, for our particular campus, it's just about the same. My understanding, a recent example of the differential cost would be borne at Portland State University, where students had to pay, I believe it's $60 per additional credit hour for to underwrite some technological initiatives in support of online education. So it's actually, Representative Denbrough, it's all across the board with regard to the difference.
And that was at Portland State, that was $60 per credit, so
yes,
and about $250 more a course.
Yes, and they ended up raising over $2 million, which was recently dispersed by the Provost Office for Technological Initiatives all over campus.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thanks. So if you could wrap up, Jim, and
I'm just about done.
We'll have questions, yeah.
Additionally, IFS would like to highlight the vast potential for collaboration between public universities in Oregon and online educational arena, whether it is team teaching with a faculty colleague across the state, having a faculty member at another institution teach a virtual course at a campus across the state, peer assessment of course design, or forming a consortium of online education providers at public university. IFS urges the legislature to consider the vast potential for collaboration in online education as a key facet of the future of education in Oregon. In conclusion, IFS wants to reiterate its position that faculty should be engaged in the future governance of higher education in Oregon. We are ready to serve on whatever committees, task forces, and the like that will enable us to protect the best interest of our most valuable resource, our students. Thank you for your attention, and I look forward to working with you in the future.
Thank you very much, Chair. Kevin.
Good morning, Chair Dembro, committee members. My name is Kevin Gable. I'm president of the OSU Faculty Senate for 2013. I'm also a professor of chemistry and a former chair of my department. I thank you for the opportunity. I'm going to try and keep my remarks brief and avoid any overlap with what Jeff has shared. I'll start by noting that at OSU, online courses and programs are really integral to how we meet our missions. Over the past 15 years, we've developed more than 30 degree and certificate programs and have more than 800 courses available online. From my own experience, when I was department chair, we saw student credit hours for online delivery grow to about 8,400 per year, which is more than 15% of our total delivery of you know, somewhere between 50 and 60,000. For my department, about three quarters of the students are not enrolled in local degree programs, and they, you know, so we call them true distance students. The rest take online offerings for various reasons, time shifting being a really popular one. While the mechanism of delivery are necessarily distinct, we do demand that online and in-person courses that are numbered the same set identical student learning outcomes, use common frameworks for selection of topics, and allow a student to sequence seamlessly between modes of delivery. The faculty that we have involved in online instruction are the same ones that are providing the in-person delivery. We do not make distinctions there. One important observation I make from our experience is that instructors involved in online delivery have rethought how they engage students and deliver material to a greater degree than have many who are not doing online instruction. The internet provides an expanded set of tools, and many of these can enhance the quality of the faculty-student dialogue in any setting. Further, the expectation to match student learning outcomes has forced us to deliberate to be deliberate in choosing what those outcomes must be. There is some skepticism among faculty about the effectiveness of the venue, and we are currently engaged at the Faculty Senate level in assessment of teaching that will allow us to directly compare achievement of learning outcomes between online and traditional face-to-face courses. As the Chancellor indicated earlier, there is national research that suggests that broadly this is the case. We want specific quantitative data for the courses we present. Not only do we need to do this to assure that we are meeting our commitment to the students, but we also see this documentation as giving us a competitive edge in the very active marketplace for online education. This comparison is something that the for-profit online institutions are absolutely incapable of providing because they have no face-to-face course offerings. We expect preliminary results in the next year. For the future, I see online education serving a variety of functions. We will clearly continue to use it to reach the non-traditional, particularly the non-residential student. The results we take from experimenting with how to deliver content will spill over into the traditional classroom. I expect most courses that we offer will earn the description of being hybrid courses in some manner, together in that we will use some element of online instruction in every course we teach. I certainly do in the organic chemistry courses that I teach. Students' need and desire to have face-to-face interaction is never going to go away, though, and I think that's the challenge to bring things together. So thank you again very much for the opportunity to come before you, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. Very thoughtful and thought-provoking. And one thing I'd like you all to follow up on, this notion of cooperation among the institutions. And, you know, potentially online education is a way to break down barriers between institutions. And I'm wondering, Steve, you talked about some common purchasing of platforms and rubrics, you know, is commonly establishing rubrics. Are things like that happening within the OUS system, Jeff and Kevin? And I mean, you are a system,
yeah.
So presumably we would expect you to be fully integrated and et cetera.
I will, you know, from my perspective, I have not seen as much of that as we might expect. On the other hand, we are already at the point where, in terms of commonly numbered courses, there is a fairly transparent articulation. So if I take Chemistry 121 at Eastern Oregon University, and I want to take Chemistry 122 at Oregon State University, our expectation is that while there may be some a few things that are out of line, by and large they will fit together in a coherent fashion. I don't think we have done very much in terms of the working on the underlying infrastructure of online delivery as we could. But the point I make on any collaborative effort that we make, whether it's in online education or in our research programs or anything else that we do, this is really dependent on two things. One is that there's got to be a set of incentives that everybody recognizes. And I think the other thing is that everybody who comes to the table needs to bring a particular strength that, you know, allows us to make something more than just the sum of the parts.
Thank you for your question, Representative Embro. From my perspective, we're not doing enough. I think part of it's the siloing of our institutions within the system. Part of it is contractual obligations of faculty to particular institutions, how we need to figure out a way to receive credit towards our contract for partnering with our colleagues in other institutions. I think there's a tremendous upside that needs to be explored, not only within OUS, but also with our community college partners that I'd urge you to contemplate.
You know, one of the things, just to follow up on that, one of the things that I've been recommending to people as we're looking at changes that will expand the purview of the HEC is, you know, to have a standing committee, as it were, a faculty advisory committee on online education to the HEC, you know, similar to, you know, the IFS as being advisory to the HEC. I think that, you know, that will allow us to maintain, you know, coherence, especially, you know, as we're moving in a direction within the university world where we have individual boards. I would hate to see us splintering online education further as opposed to taking advantage of taking the opportunity to bring people closer together, potentially, in more strategic partnership.
Okay. Chair Dembro, members of the committee, I think that's an important observation. You know, one of the things that I've seen in reading what's going on elsewhere in the country is there are good examples. I think the University of Virginia being one of them, University of California at Berkeley being another, where a top-down, you know, implementation of online education goals without doing the kind of due diligence that you're involved in today has led to some real problematic outcomes. You know, that, you know, the institutions did not know what they wanted to accomplish by entering the online market, and it wound up making the institution look bad when it was not affected as well as it could be. And I think that's the target for us to avoid, is to make sure that as we go forward, that there is this continuing dialogue between the people in the trenches who are doing the education and the folks on the Higher Education Coordinating Committee and other bodies within the state who are charged with, you know, looking at the global picture.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Dembrough. Well, one of the underarching principles of higher education is that faculty own and control the curriculum. I'm concerned with regard to what may be perceived as the marginalization of faculty in an advisory role, as opposed to our current structure using the academic slash provost council and the central role that they play in program approval. While IFS stands ready to serve in whatever capacity is needed in terms of this debate, I'd urge you to make sure that faculty have a voting seat at the table in order to protect the best interest of our students.
Boy, what a great way to end.
Yes.
your words are sweet to my ears. Thank you, gentlemen. Thank you for coming to us. This will not be the last time that this committee is going to be exploring this issue. I think we have a lot of details to get into, and also there's more forward thinking to happen. So thank you very much. With that, I'm going to close this informational hearing on online education. And colleagues, we are adjourned.
Thank you.